Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hi, dear listeners. This is Kate Riga. I'm here to make a quick pitch that you consider becoming a TPM Prime member. TPM has used the member model for over a decade now, and our loyal members are the only reason we've been able to weather the turbulence of the media landscape and avoid the fate that has befallen so many other independent outlets. For $70, you get no paywall, fewer ads, access to the Hive member forum, a members-only newsletter, and more. For $140 a year, you get all of that, plus no ads at all. Without our members, there is no podcast, not to mention that I'm out of a job. Thank you so much for listening and supporting us. We couldn't do it without you.
This is Josh Marshall, and this is the Josh Marshall Podcast with Kate Riga. Today, we're going to talk about a few things. We're going to first, you know, pick up where we left off on Friday when we did the special episode about the State of the Union address by President Biden, kind of continue to see where the sort of, you know, the vibes bump, as it were, is continuing or not continuing. Then we're going to get into, you know, Trump had this kind of misfire, at least seemingly misfire, with Social Security and Medicare. And then we have some interesting news. You know, Kate has been closely following over the, the last year, but I think it goes back 2 or 3 years, this pipeline they have with a few particularly radical Trump judges that you set up an organization down in Amarillo, Texas, go to this one guy, and there's, you know, there's a couple of them, but there's mainly this one guy down in Texas. And suddenly you can get a whole, you know, ban, just, you know, kind of ultimate judge shopping. So we've had a bit of a development on that front. And then we're going to get into, there's miscellaneous other topics we are going to get into. One thing with the State of the Union address, there's been a few polls out just today that appear to show not really any movement in the polls. The ones that have come out tend to be the sort of the lower quality ones, a lot of them, you know, a number of, you know, kind of Rasmussen and Harris and stuff like that. But really, you don't expect any bump to happen this soon. And even a bump is not something that meaningfully happens even after a week or 2 weeks. That's not how it works, really. So we can get into that. But one, you know, one of the other points about this is that, to me at least, the significant thing about Biden's State of the Union address, which, as you know, was sort of widely seen as, you know, energetic, fiery, all that kind of stuff. To me, the significance of that was stabilizing worry Democrats to kind of like, okay, we have our plan. We've got a guy. We're gonna, you know, let's do this. So I don't think that really changes at least my overall impression of things. Kate, what's your sense? How would you say? So this thing was Thursday. How are the vibes feeling to you?
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, we kind of said this last episode that it's not even the point necessarily to win over kind of undecided swing voters. Like, of course it is, but we know a lot of those people are not very politically interested or politically informed. So the odds that you had them kind of watching a 66-minute speech and being, you know, swayed by his kind of policy positions is somewhat limited. So it's more about avoiding the tranche of headlines that we would have gotten if, God forbid, he had like stumbled on his way up to the lectern or got some name really wrong or something like that. I think it's already kind of redounding to their benefit in some other ways, including days of positive headlines for Biden. Like, that is hard to come by for a Democrat, mm-hmm. you know, without the kind of the right wing media apparatus just like churning out propaganda for you all the time. So he had that. They had kind of huge donor days after the speech. You know, now he's kind of got this wave of momentum as the cabinet secretaries are fanning out across the country and they're starting their big ad buys. And, you know, they put out one a few days ago where he kind of, you know, he opens with a, I've been around a while, and does a little optimistic kind of pitch. And then they have this funny bit right at the end where they're like, okay, let's do another take. And Biden's like, I'm young and handsome. What are we even doing here kind of thing? So, you know, all of that is, I think, kind of important and necessary. And the reason that the speech was so important was to kind of head off this panic attack about replacing Biden on the top of the ballot. Like, that was a huge drag on Democratic morale, you know, from the kind of elite chatterers down to the people who actually decide elections and like door knock and volunteer. So, yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think this was even more about bolstering the home base than kind of convincing undecideds, even though, as you say, I think we can't be sure this close to it whether undecideds were touched by this at all. So, and you know, you also, I think it operates by giving a contrast, and Trump's kind of post State of the Union speech. I mean, I think it was pretty clear that he was a bit rattled by it. You know, he said mm-hmm. during the speech, like, oh, he's probably done well enough that they won't replace him. And then he's like, and that's good. I want to run against Biden, you know, with some kind of like backhanded compliment in there.
But, you know, that's the thing there that one of the very few good things about Trump and his life on social media is that you frequently get a view into his actual emotional ups and downs and cognition, right? Because I'm sure that's where he was. He was like, oh, okay, I was hoping this would be like a total pratfall and he's doing pretty well, but I wanted him to do well. And, you know, you can see his like real ideas followed by his effort to, you know, combat his real ideas and stuff. He's always been, you know, has his real stuff just right on his sleeve. Right. And in some ways, you know, it's funny. One of the things that I certainly found interesting in the 2016 election is that we were so used to, you know, something happens, a campaign gets together, they strategize, they enlist the communication shop to send out a press release. You know, in no way are you getting the sort of the immediate reaction of the person. Right. And now when you see Biden tweeting, that's not his, or, you know, when they put these little reels up on Instagram and stuff, that's not him kind of, you know, between meetings, he's like, ah, fuck Trump, you know, I'm gonna, you know, something like this. And there is something interesting about that, to the extent that you can, that you are actually hearing from the candidate. Not everybody wants to be inside the emotional world of the candidate, right? In some ways, it's cool for us as people who cover this stuff, right? That you kind of like, oh, that's what they're thinking. You know, most people, it's not like that. They don't live by politics. So, you know, just prevent our enemies from bombing us and keep the make sure there's jobs available if I lose my job and whatever, dude, stay out of my life, right? You know, so it's most people don't live and die this stuff, but that remains one of the things about that is still interesting about Trump, and slightly different topic, but it's actually one of the things that one of the reasons that I think I can tell, I think we can tell, Trump's a very different person than he was when he first ran for president 8 years ago. And there's a lot of reasons for that. You know, I did a post on this yesterday, I think, about Trump's decline, which I think is probably one part age, also one part life experience, right? That he's, you read what he says now, and it's just this, it's sort of like a digital equivalent of pressured speech and a lot of MAGA buzzwords or little two or three, you know, little chunks of two or three words that to most people it's like, what does that mean? But it's usually, you know, the 51 intelligence agents, and they're what? And they're, but they're little signifiers to things that are big in the MAGA world. But one thing I was thinking about after I wrote that, and this is kind of one of my almost the core of my understanding of Trump at this time in our politics, that, I know I'm digressing a bit here, but I wanted to make this point. I think you can really understand him and why he was so powerful in 2016 and why he is at least different. Doesn't mean he won't also be powerful, but at least very different, is that if you go back to 2016 and you remember it, as bad as he was then, every day of the campaign, the 2016 campaign, it was crystal clear he was having the time of his life. He was loving it. He was having fun. And then within about a week or 10 days after the election, it's been like a shit sandwich for him every single day since. He has been unhappy and resentful everything. And that's kind of why his campaign now is all about vengeance and grievance. It's a big difference. And anyway, that, you know, kind of frames where we are right now.
Yeah. So, you know, and one other thing that Biden's speech did was, I don't know if you saw, had to mention this specifically, but, you know, Ezra Klein was one of the ones who wrote, we discussed it here, the whole, you know, Thunderdome convention thing, right? Like, have a brokered convention, fight it out, whatever. He put out a piece after the speech where he said, you know, a performance like that will be enough to kind of keep like weak,
like nervous, now weak-kneed.
Yeah. And then linked himself to his old piece. So that was funny. You know, enough to head off criticism from them. But another thing that I thought was interesting is, so yesterday, Biden's approval level dipped to its lowest point ever. It's at like 37% right now. Today, generic Democrat took the lead in the congressional, you know, head-to-head of generic Democrat versus generic Republican for the first time since, I think, December, January, for the first time in months, which is super interesting and also further proof of this dynamic we've discussed before and have seen a lot that, you know, not too long ago, presidential approval ratings were like shackled to electability. You know, those things were just parallels. That might not be the case anymore. You know, we just might be in a place that's so kind of split and partisan that you can't really get out of the 40s, even the lower 40s. That's just kind of where all presidents are going to be. And we're still in this place where we're comparing them to kind of presidents of the recent past and being like, well, oh God, Obama was never this low, you know, things like that. So that's just an interesting kind of wrinkle while we're trying to ascertain the whole landscape that, you know, some metrics just might not be as telling as they used to be.
Yeah, I mean, one thing, you know, one thing to keep in mind is that, you know, new low was largely driven by one, what I would define as junk poll, the new version of Harris that is run by Mark Penn. But even if you take that at face value, you're still talking about like, you know, 0.5%. So even if I'm right that, you know, technical new low is, you know, kind of manipulated in a way, the larger point is still the case. Biden's approval is very low by historical standards. And yet his party is, you know, doing quite well. And we have certainly seen that in, you know, in all the by-elections and stuff like that. And so there is this disparity. And I think that in some ways, it's not surprising in the sense that if you look at, you know, what are the big, you know, kind of issue agenda things, they, most of them lean in a Democratic direction. So you do have this, you know, kind of weird disconnect, and that may be a president thing. It's also, I think, one of the reasons why, and this is a, you know, a speculative conclusion or a speculative idea. It's also one of the reasons that I think a number of Democrats, in which I would somewhat class myself, that it's a reason they're optimistic about Biden. Because basically, if you go into, if your general sense of the two parties is favoring Democrats, that is going to create a lot of, that is going to push you towards Biden, basically. If you don't particularly like either one, but your sense is you like Democrats better than Republicans, that's going to kind of tilt the field in that direction, create a sort of a gravitation in that direction. But, you know, who knows? It's certainly, as you say, historically, it was the most predictive thing in politics. Party lives or dies by the approval of its president. And even though we don't know what 2024 is going to bring, we've already sort of had the test case in 2022 and the 2023 by-elections that doesn't seem to matter in the way that it used to.
Note to listeners, when I say Medicaid here, I mean Medicare. Sorry for that. My kingdom for these programs to be named something a little more different from each other. So that's Biden's vibes bump post State of the Union. Meanwhile, kind of speaking of Trump, he had this big snafu where he did his first quote unquote mainstream interview in quite some time. And, you know, granted, it was on CNBC with like a super friendly host. So, you know, mainstream in name only, maybe, but at least a channel that like more normal people watch than the people who are watching Newsmax or OAN or whatever.
Or like Hannity. And, you know, he does like Hannity style interviews. Yeah.
Right. And this was one of like the more vintagey Trump like call in interviews, which, you know, he used to do all the time, especially when he was president. And he would just like get these people up on the phone while he was watching. And basically the host does kind of like in the old school Republican way, like bait him into saying that he wants to cut Medicaid and Social Security. You know, he opens with this whole, surely something must be done or else we'll be in this kind of debt forever. Like, isn't that right? And then Trump kind of goes, you know, I think things can be done. We blah, blah, blah. You know, it pretty quickly kind of turns word salad-y, but he definitely opens by saying like, there are definitely some things we can cut kind of thing. And it's not very replete with specifics, but it is interesting because we talk about the moments where Trump's kind of political savvy rears its head. It happens every once in a while. And Medicaid and Social Security was something that historically he has been disciplined on and has kind of used it as a wedge issue with the more, you know, establishment type Republicans that he's run against. And that was true, you know, back in 2015. And that was true when he was going against Haley and DeSantis kind of this time around. And then people always kind of say, well, but his budget always cut these programs. And it's like, of course. I mean, it's not, I'm not out here professing that Trump is an ideological crusader for Medicaid and Social Security, right? I mean, it's pretty clear that he doesn't give a fuck about policy details and he outsources that work to the more establishment Republican types who do want to cut these things. Mm-hmm. And, this is no way saying that Trump will protect these programs if he gets elected, but it is something that he's clearly felt is politically damaging to express desire to cut them. So he has not, you know, he has said that he's going to protect them and blah, blah, blah. And so he said, you know, we can cut some stuff, blah, 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 clearly trying to be amenable to the host and probably, you know, the audience that watches CNBC and the Biden campaign.
Like day traders, right. Basically. Yeah. Yeah.
And the Biden campaign pounced pretty immediately on this, you know, their rapid response. Like, it is funny, the things that, you know, the Biden campaign and more traditional Democrats, like there are some things that they're just so maddeningly slow on or quiet on, or that they don't see kind of obvious openings and like take forever to marshal a response. You know, like IVF is like that. There have been various, they come from this vein of like newer Democratic priorities that they can still be so maddeningly slow on getting a response together. But they've had at this point years to figure out the Medicaid Social Security response. So whenever a Republican steps in on that, they're like very quick to respond. And that's kind of what we saw here. And then there were some think pieces from, you know, like smart people who I do respect, kind of saying this is the way to win the election, right? You need to show normal people with normal stuff they care about. It's not so kind of theoretical as the democracy thing. This has to do with people's specific lives, kind of thing. So I would say I'm like less bullish on it than that. I am not totally convinced that you can use this one word salad sludgy response to, you know, as this kind of campaign long weapon against Trump, given that, again, this is something he's generally more careful about, and we're not likely to get him at, you know, at rallies like being like, and then I'm gonna cut Social Security, right? But it does redound to, I think, your point a little bit of he's not as sharp as he was. He's not as, you know, disciplined for Trump, which is always, you know, a funny standard, but he's not as disciplined as he was anymore. It shows that I think the infrastructure is in place to like respond forcefully to Trump missteps, which is going to be helpful to the Biden campaign as it goes on. And, you know, to the extent that this helps them kind of draw a distinction, which is, you know, a true distinction. Like, these programs are only safe under a Democratic administration. I mean, that's helpful. I think I'm a little bit less high on the idea that a stumble like this is going to A, like, reach the people who need to be reached, and B, sustain any kind of news cycle, you know, past the initial kind of 24 hours of it happening.
Yeah. I mean, I think the key to me is that, as you say, people assume rightly that Republicans want to cut these programs. That's just been a reality forever. And they assume that because it's true. Like, whenever they have a trifecta, they try for it. Now, sometimes it is just making, you know, changes in the formula over time, which is a very big deal, but doesn't, you know, it can kind of go beneath the radar because, you know, it can seem like just some math equations. And that's why people gravitate towards that. Sometimes it's as big as what George W. Bush tried in late 2004 and 2005, when it's a big structural change, and you know they've gotten pretty they were pretty burned by that. So it kind of warned them off that for a long time. But you know, behind the scenes, there is this intra-democratic debate between, you know, it needs to be more kitchen table stuff, you know, economic stuff, versus it needs to be democracy, needs to be abortion. The reality is you need to hit the opponent with everything. That's just always the way. The idea that you're not going to do one and you are going to do the other, that's silly. And certainly there are questions of strategic emphasis, and you want to, you know, campaign people will tell you, you want to tell a kind of a cohesive story. But a lot of these things are, a lot of these things kind of break down at the, a lot of these dichotomies break down at the level of implementation. Because you say, you know, Trump, big scary guy who's going to break all the good things. You know, he's going to ban abortion. He wants to, you know, cut your Social Security benefits. And Biden's the one who's, you know, creating a lot of jobs and saving the good stuff. And again, some of that is what you have here. But I think that a lot of these things are not as dichotomous as the debates would have us think when you get to, you know, what are you actually gonna focus on? And different, look, it's a big country. There, different people respond to different things. So you just, you know, you have to hit all the stuff. It's kind of commonsensical.
Right. So another kind of piece of bad news for Trump is that last night we had the Georgia primaries. And at this point, you know, we know who the nominees are. We've known who the nominees are for forever. But now we really know who the nominee is because there are no other Republicans running. But still, Georgia got a bit of attention because Nikki Haley ended up with around 13%, about 77,000 votes. And there's been some kind of little back and forth about how much this matters, because we know that about 20,000 of those votes were cast on Election Day, which means that the rest of it was cast in the early vote. We, you know, Josh, you did the math kind of before we came on, and that breaks down to about 2 weeks before she dropped out, about 1 week after she dropped out. So there's a little bit of kind of fogginess around when those votes were cast. Even though, as we were kind of saying before the show, it feels a little like I get why people are concerned about it, because if she's out of the race totally, that feels like more vociferous of a protest vote than when she was in the race. But I mean, voting for Nikki Haley was always kind of an anti-Trump protest vote, even when she was at the kind of quote unquote height of her campaign.
Yeah, what I said before we started was, you know, it's a bit of a notional difference. Like, does it really matter that much when she technically bowed out? I mean, I'm not even sure she ever bowed in, right? This has clearly for weeks been a protest vote, despite the fact that Trump is obviously going to be the nominee. So, you know, the fact that she was technically still campaigning until a week ago and hasn't been since isn't quite as big of a, you know, as a meaningful thing as one might think. I think if you, I think as Kate said, they had early voting for 3 weeks. So 2 weeks before the dropout, if I have the math right, 1 week after, early votes tend to be, you know, kind of push back. It accelerates towards Election Day. So I think it's probably fair to say that maybe if we say about a third of the Haley vote was Election Day vote, probably another third was after she dropped out, and then, you know, a third before. So it's, you know, these things continue to have significance in a race that we have always known is going to be a very tight race. And in some ways, it is particularly true in Georgia, because Georgia is a state where the Democratic gains have basically been in, you know, people who have moved into the state from bluer parts of the country, professionals, you know, educated professionals, affluent people who were consistent Republican voters, but just couldn't deal with Trump. And so you've had a slice of those people who, you know, came out for the two Democratic senators, came out for Biden. A lot of them, or at least a significant number of them, also came out for Kemp, the very conservative governor in the state, who has politically been very successful and pretty smartly and strategically did not bend for Trump. I mean, did all sorts of things that Trump wanted, but wouldn't go along with the big steal kind of stuff. So it makes sense that we would see this in Georgia, because we know that Georgia is a place where the possibly emerging Democratic coalition there is made up of a significant sliver of, you know, affluent, educated, suburban voters who are not liberals, but just will not accept Trump. So, you know, these things, even at the margins, matter.
More of this scintillating content after these messages.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure, with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Back to the show, right? So moving on to a different topic, we had this kind of surprise announcement from the Judicial Conference on Tuesday. And the Judicial Conference is the policymaking body for the federal courts. You know, they kind of put out like recommendations for the lower courts to adopt. And yesterday, they put out this announcement that they're making a policy change to really bat down this problem of judge shopping. And, you know, our listeners will remember judge shopping is when particularly kind of right-wing litigants seek out these divisions that only have one or two judges in them. So the chances of getting the judge you want are very high. And then they kind of consistently go back to these often Trump appointees, these super partisan judges who they can all but count on getting a win from. And a lot of times this will be anti-Biden administration stuff, you know, whether that be kind of mifepristone or an EPA rule, you know, something like that. And they'll go to often Matthew Kaczmarek in Amarillo because he gets 100% of the cases in his division. So you go there, and then he and his ilk are like increasingly comfortable handing down these national injunctions. So, you know, usually judges are supposed to keep relief as narrow as possible, you know, keep it confined to the plaintiffs before them. But these people will, you know, stop a Biden administration rule for the entire country. And then if it is Kaczmarek, its next step is the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, the most like infamously conservative appellate court in the country. So there your odds are pretty good at getting him upheld. And then that leaves the Supreme Court as your salvation here. And even if you do get the district judge overturned at the appellate court level or the Supreme Court level, you know, that's months where whatever policy this is kind of stopped in its tracks. And this is just happening over and over and over. And it is kind of activist litigants, you know, anti-abortion or just this kind of coterie of right-wing legal people who work to thwart the Biden administration on all kinds of topics. But then it's also, you know, litigants that would be considered kind of bigger deals, right? Like the state of Texas, for instance, avoids Austin like the plague and then files all their cases against Biden in these, you know, Amarillo or these other kind of Trumpy small divisions, arguing, well, you know, there are Texans in Amarillo who are affected by this. And this has just been going on for a while. And, you know, it's attracted the attention of the Senate. I did some reporting on legislative fixes, but, you know, with the filibuster and kind of lack of Republican support, those were never going anywhere. You've had Supreme Court justices write about it, including Gorsuch. The DOJ, like, habitually now will kind of write in their briefs, can we please get a venue transfer? There's no reason for this case to be here. And of course, the people who get to decide that are the judges presiding. So that's almost always a resounding no. But despite how blatant the judge shopping has been, there was very little optimism around experts on this topic that the courts would do any kind of self-policing, in part because it would almost be admitting that judges are partisan actors, right? Like, if there's anything judicial institutions do, it's this John Robertsian, you know, we just call balls and strikes. All of our judges are upstanding and incredible. And so addressing this topic would have to be at least implicitly saying, like, we see that all these cases are getting funneled to the same few guys, you know, and we know what that means. Nevertheless, on Tuesday, they came out saying, there's going to be a new policy. This applies to federal and state actions that if anyone is seeking this nationwide relief in these lawsuits, that it has to go through a randomization process. They can no longer kind of file suit in Amarillo and know they're going to get Kaczmarek. Instead, it'll be something broader than that. And the reason there's ambiguity there is because they put out this press release and they didn't link to any policy text or any kind of longer form answer of how this will be enforced. And so I talked to a whole bunch of people about this yesterday. And the kind of summary of thought is, this is great and shocking that the Judicial Conference was willing to take action on especially such kind of a partisan issue, with reservations about we need to see what this is going to look like, how it's going to be enforced, you know, how clerk's offices are going to do this across the country. I spoke to two experts who had submitted a proposal to fix judge shopping as a federal rule. So to add it to the actual code, because it would be, you know, more ironclad, like parties in court could cite to it and bring it up and say that this isn't being followed, versus what the judicial conference generally does, which is hand down recommendations, which are nearly always adopted by the lower courts. But, you know, it's a little... it has a little less teeth, perhaps.
Right.
So that's where we are now. We're probably going to get, the plan is they're going to send out a memo to federal judges by the end of the week, policy text in the next couple months or so. So, you know, first blush, early stuff, but still, I mean, it's a huge deal. Like, this would really defang some of the power of these Trump appointees and would kind of block a pipeline where the Biden administration is getting stopped whenever they do anything, you know, on the progressive side and anything that is significant. Like, you know, that's getting shut down from all different kinds of agencies. Even the Supreme Court's docket is full of kind of anti-administration cases. So stopping the pipeline that helps it get out to the Supreme Court so easily, I mean, that's a really big deal.
Is it so? Two questions. I mean, this is the main question I had for you, and you've, I think, addressed it, is how much teeth this has. I mean, I'm not, you know, this isn't my area of expertise. So I know this thing exists, but I wasn't really clear the extent to which it's just sort of like advisory, this should be our policy, versus kind of like it's binding in some way. But it sounds like we actually don't know, but I'm curious what people speculated the actual mechanism would be. So like if you bring suit in Amarillo, does that mean that they say, okay, you can't do Amarillo since there's only one dude there? Or do they kind of like create some sort of, you know, drawing straws where they put in a few other dudes from other parts of Texas? Do we know how they actually operationalize that? Or is there informed speculation about what the options are?
So this is definitely all speculation, because clerk's offices, with like pretty good reason, keep it a secret about how cases are assigned. So you can't really game the system. But the way that I think it would happen is like Kaczmarek is the only judge in the Amarillo division, but he is one of the judges in the Northern District of Texas. So instead of just kind of giving all cases filed in Amarillo to him, ones at least that are, you know, kind of seeking a national injunction on a federal or state issue, I would assume it seems the most straightforward way that they would do it is kind of put it into the hopper for everyone in the Northern District and see who gets drawn. And in some ways, like, you know, this isn't going to root out judge shopping permanently. There are some districts that have a ton of conservatives, right? That you have a pretty good chance of drawing a straw. But it is, everyone I talked to said, like, this is the most obvious way to kind of root it out, right? To get it where it lives. And the thing I kind of asked them all is, okay, we don't know how much teeth this is going to have. We don't know if it's just going to be a recommendation, something not binding. Do you see a world where, at, you know, whether the circuit court level or the district court level, there's, you know, lack of compliance where people are just like, no, we're not doing this? People seemed pretty confident that that wouldn't happen. Like, you might get some kind of belly aching from these individual judges who are enjoying their place of prominence in the right-wing legal world. But by and large, people have respected what the judicial conference kind of tells them to do. This happened with, like, cameras in the courtroom is kind of a big one where they did all these tests and then they came down and said there'll be no cameras in federal court. And that kind of, you know, went across the board. There was a littler version of this exact dynamic happening where there was like this one judge in Waco, Texas, who was like, give me all the patent cases. Like, I'm gonna come out on patent cases the way you want. And he was getting 3/4 of all the cases across the whole country were going to Waco. And actually, John Roberts kind of added this in his little like year in review letter type thing, where he was like, we should probably take a gander at that. And then the chief of that district did this randomization thing to, you know, prevent this one guy from getting all the cases. So it's hard to say, because the judicial conference is not like a wellspring of activism, right? Like, they don't usually really do big stuff. But people by and large seem to think that even if it was somewhat non-enforceable, the way that they would have to do it in practice seems like it would be a little bit hard to rig, you know, especially in a way that wouldn't attract a ton of attention, because the guys like Kaczmarek, I mean, they've made themselves into national figures, at least for people who are kind of interested in this legal stuff. And I think an alarm would be raised pretty quickly if, you know, they affect this change and then every single anti-Biden case is ending up in Kaczmarek's court anyway, right?
Now, isn't there, do we have any visibility into, you know, the people making these decisions, how they're chosen, you know, what are the mechanics? Because as you say, this seems to, it's the judicial right wing that is going to town on this. So do we have any visibility into the decision-making, the personnel, anything like that?
Not really. It's made up of judges, you know, from various parts of the country.
Right.
You had one kind of do a press conference when it was done. One expert told me her thinking on this is that there are still a lot of conservative judges in the system who are not MAGA judges. You know, we still have a lot of like Reagans and Bushes who are still alive and still working on the bench. And those people were born of a different judicial tradition. You know, for a long time, the conservative judicial position was you kind of avoid making change. Like you try to keep things the same. I mean, and that manifested in ways that are totally foreign to us with kind of right-wing judges now, including being very hesitant to like knock down federal agency actions and things like that. And that's been totally turned on its head. But the sense that those more old school Republican judges are not happy with what the Kaczmareks are doing, you know, either from a philosophical or kind of, you know, legacy, institutionalism, legitimacy type perspective, and that those people, you know, the ones who have been around for a long time tend to have more positions of like authority in these policymaking bodies. So that might have been a source for this seemingly more like, you know, it may kind of explain why the judicial conference acted in response to complaints, which are nearly always only coming from like the left wing, whether that be kind of politicians or scholars.
Right, right. Well, you know, one thing that we had a new round of articles, and it was the headline of David Kurtz's morning memo this morning, that one of the big things that Donald Trump and his crew is promising is this thing called, I think it's Schedule F.
That's
F?
Right.
Okay. So basically what this was for listeners, I know Kate knows this, very late in the Trump administration, they did this executive order. I guess there's executive orders and there's executive memorandums, whatever. Functionally, it's basically the same thing. And what it purported to do was to take the right now, and for many, many years, for many decades, there's about 4,000 members of the executive branch who are there to be hired and fired at the will of the current president. So when you talk about, you know, filling out the executive branch, not just the secretaries, but the deputies, and, you know, there's a system here, those people, you get to put your people in charge. Okay. So by executive order, Trump, and this was, again, very late, like October of 2020, like a month before the election or something, did this thing that took it from like 4,000 to like 50,000, you know, so dug a whole layer deeper into the federal bureaucracy and said, those are now political appointees who I can just, if I don't like the look on their face, I can fire them. So this was quickly, you know, kind of overtaken by the fact that Trump lost the election, the coup attempt, blah, 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 blah. Biden got rid of it immediately when he came in. But it has been sort of central Trumpite doctrine. We're going to do this again on day one. And we are either going to fire all of those people, replace them with, you know, MAGA true believers, or, you know, the sort of the, you know, for lack of a better word, you know, the moderate wing of MAGA-dom says, you know, look, we're not going to have to fire all of them. We're just going to fire a few of them. And then everybody else is going to keep their head down, functionally the same thing. And that, you know, may be true at some level. In any case, that is a big, big deal when you talk about sort of, you know, creeping dictatorship and stuff like that. You know, what do we mean that democracy is on the line? Well, it's things like that. And it is well worth thinking about. And the Trump people have been pretty candid about this because, again, executive orders don't they got to get through the courts, right? You know, president can say whatever he wants, but it's what the courts say that he or she can get away with. And the Trump people say, you know what? We appointed a lot of judges. We're feeling pretty good about what the courts are going to say. And I think that is still a bit of an open, some open question, but it certainly, there's a decent chance they'll be right. And it is worth, we kind of know this, but it is worth just focusing on the fact nowadays, President Biden can say, okay, I'm going to, an executive order that my administration is going to do this, that, and the other, the kind of things that have long been seen within the president's, within the president's domain. And it's not just Thomas Kaczmarek, all sorts of Trump, you can go to a relatively favorable district and you get someone to say, oh, yep, got to look at this injunction. We'll see what the Supreme Court says in 3 or 4 years. So on the one hand, you have this universe in which kind of everything the president does by executive action is immediately held up in the courts. And yet it's treated as plausible, and it is plausible, that Donald Trump will be able to just come in and basically like overturn the civil service system as it's existed for like a century or upwards of a century. It gets a little fuzzier that far back. And judges will be say, hey, unified executive, man, this looks good to me. So, it shows you the impact of the politicized judiciary. Although I will say this to me is, if Trump is elected, this will be, I think, where the rubber meets the road for the current judiciary, and particularly the Supreme Court, that they have their own vision of judicial oligarchy that they are totally down with, but it's not quite the same as Trump's vision, right? And that's why I think with Trump on the, criminal stuff and, on those kind of things, they will do anything that is kind of theoretically within the sort of expanded strike zone for him, to help him out, to help the Republican Party out. But they're not going to say, yeah, presidents are all immune, go for it. But will they help him within the range of things that kind of passes their sense of propriety? Absolutely. But if he's elected, you are instantly going to be operating on that, on that part of the spectrum, things that are totally whacked like this. And then it'll get, I was going to say it's going to get interesting. It'll get terrifying, but it'll, terrifying can also be interesting at the same time. So that's one thing potentially we have to look forward to if Trump is elected.
So we're going to wrap up with a buck you, if you will, from Ken Buck to Speaker Mike Johnson. So we knew that Buck was going to leave or that he wasn't going to run again. He's been kind of an interesting character of these last couple years because he is he's Trumpy. I mean, he's MAGA. He's definitely not one of these kind of old school conservatives. He's in the newer vein, but it seems that January 6th was a breaking point for him, which is like a crazy thing to say with incredulity because, yeah, obviously, but it really does. And he's kind of come onto the stage occasionally talking about, we can't keep lying to people about this. And that's something you hear from almost no Republicans, right? It does make him a bit singular, even though in the rest of his politics, he's really not very establishment-y by and large. So we knew he was going to leave. This was part of Republicans just making for the doors. Anyone who has any interest in governing or doing anything outside of the kind of performative aspects of the office have all been leaving in droves. He said he was going to leave. Then we find out this week that after leaving a cursory voicemail for Mike Johnson, not ever reaching him in person, 30 minutes later, he announced that he's leaving next week. He didn't even give like a 2 week notice. He's like, that's it, I'm out, which is funny because reducing Johnson's margin at any point would be pretty cruel. But he did it with, you know, his statement was totally bare bones. No, I feel so proud to have blah, blah. You know, it was very like, yeah, I'm out of here, done. And also reducing the margin right before, you know, April 30th is the sequestration date, is when the across the board budget cuts kick in if they still haven't funded the government fully. Doing it before then is a specific kind of middle finger. And the part that I think is kind of, I don't know, if I almost respect, is like, this is like when you know you're leaving a job and you're about to go through some like high stress, high work period. And you're just like, no. And I know my days are numbered. I'm not going to stay for this stressful bit. I'm just going to bounce early. So, you know, he kind of looked at what they had ahead, which is this very difficult task of appropriations, especially when they've got this like coterie in their party who's going to say no to anything that needs Democratic support, which is everything. You know, Johnson's gavel will be on the line, shutdown, sequestration. And he's just like, I'm just going to go. No, I don't have anything lined up. I'm just choosing to leave right now. Thank you and goodbye.
The other funny thing about that, I mean, I always find these midterm resignations a little off, because sometimes someone will say, oh, you know, I was just hired. I have this new professorship, or I'm going to take over the foundation for blah, blah, blah. So I'll be leaving early. And like, okay, fine, you know, life happens, but there is a part of me that's kind of like, you know, you're hired to do this. Like, what? Like, sometimes you have an illness, you have something in the family, blah, 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 blah. But it's always a little weird. But as you say, the funny part here is he didn't even say like, oh, I have to take over my new fellowship at the Colorado Center for stuff, you know, whatever. He just kind of said, I'm done. I'm just going to sit at home and watch TV or something like that, which was another level of fuck you. He didn't even kind of like, you know, line up some notional sinecure that he said he had to go, you know, he was needed right away. But, you know, you almost didn't put a fine enough point on it. This guy is like Joe Freedom Caucus, like, you know, just the biggest nutball, or at least was the biggest nutball. And suddenly kind of out of, you know, retiring kind of loosens these guys' lips a little. But this isn't like someone who you kind of figure was always just sort of, you know, grinning and bearing it with Trump. He's like Joe Freedom Caucus, Joe Trump, basically. And now, or for the last, I don't know, the last 6 months or so, he's like going like almost Adam Kinzinger, right? Like during the bizarre month when they were doing kind of, you know, Thunderdome speakership, reality TV or whatever, he kept going on like CNN. And he's like, we got to stop lying to people. Enough of this. Like, the election was stolen. It wasn't stolen. He lost. Get over it. But the funny, and he was like, so he was not voting for anybody because like, we can't have another person who is doing this big lie stuff. But he's also one of like, what is it? The 8 people or 10 people who voted to can Kevin. You know, so he's just so all over the, and even there, it wasn't like, it was almost like he almost couldn't explain after the fact why he had even done that, because he spent the next month saying, this is childish. Why are we here? We need to be grownups. Like, dude, you started this. So yeah, so now they're down to these ridiculously low margins, right? They're going into the period now where they are no longer going to be able to keep stringing together these continuing resolutions, which they've been doing basically through Johnson's whole time in office. So he's kind of, you know, slipping Johnson the shiv just at either the worst possible moment or the best possible moment, depending on your political preferences or sense of humor.
So that's the note that Ken Buck leaves us on, you know.
Yeah.
Good luck with your future ventures, you ideological weirdo. Decide what camp you're going to be in, my friend.
Truly, truly weird. But good content. We appreciate it. And I think that's all we have for this week. And yep, we will be back next week with another episode.
All right. See you then.
See ya.
The Josh Marshall Podcast is hosted by me, TPM reporter Kate Riga, and TPM founder, editor-in-chief Josh Marshall. The show is produced by Jackie Wilhelm. Thanks to Why Not Jansfeld for our podcast theme song, and thanks to all our TPM members who make this possible. Rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and subscribe wherever you listen.